to the ashes of the Imperium.
Hello and welcome to Ashes of the Imperium. My name is Dan and today I'm joined by the wonderful Steve and the lovely Gary. And today we're talking all about the final Arcs of Omen book, The Lion.
Rah.
Rah indeed. Oh,
beautiful, Steve.
There you go. I've been practicing.
Nice. You have. Nice, yeah, yeah. I like it. What did you guys think of this book?
Well, this is the first actual arcs that I've read. And you know what? I think it set off as like an action film and, you know, it delivers that. I thought it was pretty decent. I liked it.
Yeah. So let's be clear. This is the final one, right?
Yeah. It certainly sells itself as, or it comes across as the grand finale, doesn't it?
Does it? We'll talk about that maybe later.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's Gary's hit the nail on the head. It's a high octane, adrenaline fueled, all lots of big baddies, all having a big punch up. Some really nice bits in it I really enjoyed. So yeah, and it's good to have a Primarch back, isn't it?
Absolutely. Another one. I feel like we're almost running out of Primarchs to bring back.
He says, I can't believe they just released another Chaos one.
Oh, ba-dum-ts. Drum roll, Gary. And this is coming from a Blood Angels fan, so I'm just, much like the characters in the book, a little bit sad that yeah. Our Primarch will never come back.
If they do another one, they might do Sanguinius.
Well, to be fair, actually, I have had a thought about this. So I think they could probably do, like, the spirit of Sanguinius or something like that, in the same way that in the Warhammer Old World you had Durthu, the tree man character, and now that same unit is then called the Spirit of Durthu, and it's just the same model. But like, you could have like the Sanguinor, comma, the Spirit of Sanguinius or something like that, you know, and you could just release the Sanguinor as a Primarch sized model.
I mean, I don't think anyone would not buy a sweet plastic Sanguinius, would they?
I certainly would.
Yeah.
So we'll have a bit of a previously on Arcs of Omen, just to kind of refresh the listeners with where we're at with the story, because the story has had its perhaps ups and downs. Don't get me wrong. We love a segue on this podcast. We love a little kind of narrative side road to explore down. I feel like, you know, the Farsight episode was that narrative side road. We've got a story about Chaos versus the Imperium, and then suddenly there's just this random, like, you know, Farsight side note, whatever.
You know whose new model's really nice?
Well, where's my Snickrot Arx of Omen book then?
Yeah, that's fair. Well, he's so sneaky.
He is. Yeah.
He didn't even sneak in there.
I think Lionel Johnson's the hide-and-seek champion of the 41st millennium, isn't he?
Definitely. I mean, I think that is possibly that, like, I had to reread the first couple of bits because I just have no idea where he came from. He's just training on a Blood Angel ship. And I was like, how did he get here? Yeah. True mystery.
Like a good podcast host, I obviously read this book far, far in advance of recording this evening, and definitely not immediately before that we started recording. But also today on
I thought I was going to be the latest to reading it.
No.
I was quite happy when I got the message from Steve early this morning saying I've just finished it. Like, okay, I'm not doing too badly then.
Well,
we just forget it, won't we? We're all so absent-minded. If we read this like a week ago, that would be it.
Me, my ADHD and deadlines, they just don't work well together. So if I leave it to the last minute, it will only take a minute. And that is why I'm forever late. But today we're recording this today on the 11th of April, and we'll be releasing this I think on the 15th of April, when the Dante model, the Lion model, and the Lion Arcs of Omen book, as well as like a lovely limited edition Black Library Lion book, goes up for pre-orders. So if you're listening to this and you wanted to try and order that limited edition Black Library book, tough luck, you're probably too late. So by the time you get, you know, 3 minutes into this podcast, it'll probably be gone. But hey, whatever. I'm sure you can buy it for £700 on eBay.
To be fair, three minutes in, you are halfway through the Farsight episode.
So we start the book, as Gary says, in this weird, awkward bit. And the article that was released today on the 11th about Dante, Commander Dante is back and burning holes in heretics with his new data sheet. Right at the end of the article, it says, Commander Dante has been as active as ever crossing the Rubicon Primaris. Commander Dante has been as active as ever since crossing the Rubicon Primaris and has spent his time tracking down a strange phenomenon terrorizing isolated bale fleets. Upon boarding his first Archivomen, Dante found the place deserted, safe of piles of heretic Astartes corpses and some oddly spectral plant life. What kind of being could commit such wholesale slaughter on the forces of chaos? With a fondness for forests and a millennia-old grudge to settle. Your guess is as good as ours, but if anyone deserves credit for finding the Imperium's next great saviour, it's the good commander. And I nearly linked this article to you guys on our little WhatsApp chat.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of needed.
Being like, oh my God, like, I wonder who this is. And I went, oh no, I won't do that because it'll reveal to the guys that I haven't read the book in case it's mentioned in the book. And then I opened up the book, and as you say, like, beyond the kind of little paragraph of introduction, you then go straight into a double page spread of effectively Lionel Johnson training on a training area on the battle barge of the Blood Angels. And you're like,
before we skip past it, I want to go back to what you're saying about that little segment on Dante's data sheet, because it sounded like the end of like a college movie, like since crossing the Rubicon Primaris. What's Dante been up to? It's his LinkedIn account.
Or like a BuzzFeed article. It's like,
yeah. What's he been up to? There we go. It's great. It's lovely. Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that we kick this off with my favourite thing in the book, which are the Risen.
Yes.
Which are so cool. So they're basically the Fallen that Lionel Johnson has looked around and basically decided, you're not actually Chaos. You're a good person. Come with me. And they basically start the Risen, which is, to be honest, they started on like an 11 with that for me. So it was hard to beat it because they were super cool.
Yeah, I think for me that's, you know, he's the man to bring the chapter back together, isn't he? He's going to get the band back together, isn't he? So, that was a super cool moment. And I think, you know, when we see them appear with the rest of the chapter, which are mainly made up with the Unforgiven, it's an interesting kind of interaction there, isn't it? So I won't spoil it for later, but yeah.
I was going to say, it did make me chuckle though, how like all that they're about is hunting the Fallen, and then like these black armored Astartes appear and they're like, you remind me of, what are you? It's like, come on! Like,
it's on the tip of my tongue.
If someone is going to know who they are, it's going to be the supreme grandmaster of the Dark Age.
I still love that moment. I think in the Vashtor book when all these kind of dark hooded figures rock up like in a blast of kind of teleportation light, and they're all like, oh, it's the Fallen, and they're like, no, it's just the Alpha Legion and word bearers with some hoods on.
Yeah.
And the lights are off. And whereas this time when the Fallen actually turn up with a new rebrand of the Risen, they're like, who are you guys? Like, what are you doing here?
It's all about branding, guys. It's what it's about. You know, remarket yourself. You can do anything you want.
Great PR campaign.
Right, Dan, come on.
So we start off, stick to the stay on target. We launch into effectively Lionel Johnson having been found. And just immediately prior to that, there's a little kind of like narrative snippet saying that effectively the Blood Angels chapter master Dante has been kind of chasing these little warp signatures around the galaxy. And it says many eyewitnesses stray into lurid mythologizing. However, certain similarities persist. He is a warrior, the being that they are chasing, who's got all these different names called the Unforgiving Knight, Tyranny's End, Beast Slayer, the Cowled Giant, etc. He is a warrior, larger than any battle brother, but clad in ornate power armor. He goes hooded and cloaked. He bears a mighty sword and a glowing golden shield. He steps from the shadowed roads of a dark forest that is not truly there. His hatred of chaos in all its forms is absolute. His slaying of monsters and tyrants, swift and thorough. Sometimes he fights alone, sometimes accompanied by black-armored Adeptus Astartes, whose nature remains mysterious. And you just think, whoa, like, that's suggesting it's the Lion. Like, I wonder how we're going to find the Lion, what his return's going to be like. The context within this galaxy-shifting narrative change is going to happen. And then you go on to the next page, and it's like, yeah, sup, guys, on the Lion.
I'm bored this shit now. And he could just disappear as well. He seems like a terrible guest.
Doesn't hang around to do the dishes, does he?
No, he's just gone. He's like, oh, okay. It's like Dante becomes a parent.
And then the narrative switches over to the Dark Angels, who, if we cast our minds back to the end of the Vashtor book, were interrogating some heretic Astartes, and they were kind of thinking, they'd been told about the Somnian Stars, which is where they'd been led to believe that Vashtor was building the assembling the key fragments to this thing called the Key that this whole narrative arc is all about. Narrative arc, oh, is what it is.
And they were like the name of the book.
Smooth. You can't see it, but I'm doing finger guns. So you think, okay, is this going to be a trap? You know, what's going to be happening there? Is there some, you know, what did you guys think before you got to this bit in the book? What did you think might be happening over in the Somnian Stars? Steve, what was
on your mind? I mean, I think even the interrogators kind of went, hang on a minute. I think it was, it felt like a trap. I didn't know what they were trying to get. You know, what were they trying to do? They kind of almost had the rock at some stage. So it didn't feel like they'd fumbled the ball on the first encounter with the rock, so they then had to do the trap. We kind of get this sense that Vashtor's got these, you know, complicated machinations and plans, and everything's, you know, he's like 10 steps ahead of us and all this sort of kind of stuff. So it kind of felt like there had to be something, a reason for this. But yeah, and we see the good guys kind of going prepared, trying to scout ahead, trying to understand what's actually going to be there when they get there. It works as a setup.
I find it's this become a slight narrative cliche where there's a trap. How's the best way to find out what happens? Activate the trap. See, to me, that is very much the worst way to find what is going to happen to you in a trap. Like, I don't think many like wilderness animals get away with that theory. There's this trap. We know it's a trap, but we're going to go into it and see what happens because that's the best way to do it. No, my advice is the best way is to go in the exact opposite way of the trap. And then you'll tend to be all right. You know, that's my verdict on it. But, you know,
although had they not sprung the trap themselves or gone to the location of the alleged trap, they wouldn't have then found the engine, which they did, didn't they? And what was the engine?
So we have the to be fair, I thought this part was really cool. Like I genuinely do like what.
Yeah,
what,
it's what was, wasn't it?
So it's basically a twisted version of Caliban. Isn't it? So I found this like Vashtor's explanation on this really cool. Is he's basically like a clanger. He's just collected all the bits from when the Caliban originally exploded, and it's like, well, if you get enough pieces together, and kind of like, you know, if you buy a secondhand puzzle, sure, three or four or five of the bits are missing, but you can still kind of make it up. So he's kind of collected all these little bits of Caliban to stitch together this demon world that he's called the Wormwood. And obviously the Dark Angels aren't too happy about this, because, you know, it is probably quite distressing to see. Like, you know, I think we all know the Dark Angels have some hang-ups about what happened, and they've really not dealt with those issues yet, and now they see this like twisted version of their home world all demonic and chaosy, which was pretty cool.
And that kind of sends them into effectively a rage overdrive. They're kind of overcome with as you say, like lots of that's probably a real trigger point for them, seeing their beloved homeworld in a kind of heretical shadow of its former self.
I mean, Caliban was pretty covered in quite a lot of chaosy things, wasn't it? Like, that's what the knights were all about, going and destroying. So I assume it's just wrapped up a little bit, but you know, there's
and it's effectively been made into like this kind of dark Mechanicus demon planet,
and like there is a big old summoning pool there as well.
There is. And who do they summon?
It's another angel.
Yes, the red angel. In the red corner, we have.
Yeah. And now you might.
Where are the Blood Angels? Which corner are they in? this is a very confusing triangle.
This is just it's the last book. Just think of this as a Royal Rumble, Dan. That's basically what happens. You have the first like contenders in the ring, and then the bell rings, and another big name comes out to join in.
They get to tag
in with the metal chair.
Yeah. I mean, you get Angron appearing, don't you? And Angron does the thing that Angron does, which is smash.
Yeah.
And this is, again, like, love the Angron model. I find the narrative for Angron as a character a bit, what's the word, one-sided? One-dimensional?
Yeah, it's a bit one-dimensional, isn't
one-dimensional.
It?
One-dimensional, yeah.
And I think in this aspect, it's fine, because it's only, five or six pages, where I can imagine a whole Arc's book on Angron to be a bit, you know, laborious, because it's, you know, that is what Angron is. That is what World Eaters are, you know. It's not to get anything, you know, not sullying their name. They you know, blood for the blood god.
Yes, and indeed skulls for the skull throne.
Exactly, you know, they know who they are. That's a great thing.
At least their branding and narrative is consistent, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know what you're getting.
Not like these Dark Angels, like, we're going to kill all the fallen. No, we're going to fight alongside the risen. Well, pick one, lads.
Yeah.
Pick a side. Oh, wait, you can't do that either.
You know who I thought would have a bigger part in this book? Abaddon.
Yeah, he plays this kind of not quite puppet master.
He's a bit, I'm going to say it, Dan, he's a bit of a voyeur in this. He just kind of watches.
Yeah.
I think that's okay, because he's never really truly trusted Vashtor. He's just too much of a demon for me to really trust him. And I think for him to go wading in, it's like, yeah, you carry on, son. If you can get this to happen, then that's all good. But I think it kind of works for me.
Yeah. I do like it near the end, where he's kind of, Aban actually says, you know what? I like this demon. So he's not like other demons. I like him. He sticks to his guns. I like it. It's like, yeah, that's quite we've weird got like for Aban to say.
A little nascent bromance going on, haven't we?
Yeah, I think that's like the nicest thing from this book. It's just like, oh, Vashtor and Aban are just mates now. You know, they've created this horrific demon world that's going to go munching through the webway, but, you know.
But excellently segwayed onto the point of this aberration that they're creating called the Wormwood, the artist previously known as...
Yeah, the Interstellar Caliban. Pac-Man.
Absolutely. So they basically created this big Pac-Man machine, planet-sized demon monstrosity, which is going to kind of eat its way into... it's like a tunneling thing. And it's going to... Yeah. Tunnel into or make new webway tunnels kind of between reality and the warp. So in the kind of like the bit of unreality that is that the webway exists in, this machine can kind of burrow into. And it has three kind of prime fragments, and we've got they've got two of them, which is one's the plague heart and one is the Ouroboros, and then this other one, which is what was the other one, Gary?
The Tuchalucha engine.
And what was the other one, Steve?
The Tumultuature.
Where's the M come from in that word?
I love snow. No, don't mock Steve. I love that he's gone with it. He's happy with his. Leave him be. So Dan kind of spoiled it with probably the actual pronunciation of it, wasn't it, Dan?
Well, listeners, I'd love to please send us a voice note or something, email over to ashesoftheimperium@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your pronunciation of them, and perhaps we can collect a bunch of them and play them on the next episode. But I suggested that perhaps the two CHs in this word were a hard C, like chaos, and it was Tukulka.
Yeah, which kind of makes it sound like it's a thing.
Yeah. The stutter. Now I'm struggling with it. So it's like being 15 again and having a terrible stutter. The Tukulka engine. There we go. I think that makes sense. And actually, I Googled it because I thought maybe this is a thing. A bit like when we had the, what's the AI called, Steve, from your program?
Auric.
Auric. Yeah, and then it keeps saying the same word but differently.
Plasma?
That sounded like Steve had recorded that a while ago. He was just playing that. He'd forgotten how to stop for me. You're like one of those Mr. T's in your pocket kind of thing. You just kept on pressing that. That was I really enjoyed that, Steve. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Available for parties and barbecues.
Yeah, fantastic.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, well, sorry. In all that, in the midst of all that, I didn't actually catch what was it? The Auriac, is it?
Auriac.
The Auriac. So much like that, I wondered whether perhaps it was a thing from some other pop culture reference that I didn't get, and it was a thing in reality. But it has been written about, this little triumvirate of things has been written about in the Dark Angels books written by, I want to say, Gav Thorpe.
Yeah, because it was mentioned that they've used the Tukulka engine before with hideous results, and I was
absolutely
like, I wonder what it would have been nice if they went over that again.
Well,
it
was if you read the Legacy of Caliban novel series written by Gav Thorpe, then I'm gonna go into some spoilers here, but you will find out that effectively they gathered them all three together. So the Tukulka engine is an ancient sentient device and possible warp entity of unknown origin. Tukulka is part of a triumvirate of similar entities, the Ouroboros and Playcart, which when combined...
So they've all been mentioned, okay.
Yeah, they have been. Which when combined can create a rift that bridges space and time. On its own, Tukulka is capable of extremely efficient, precise, and accurate warp jumps. And that is from the Lion novella. During the Horus Heresy, Tukulka was discovered by Lionel Johnson in the Perditus system after Death Guard under Kallus Typhon, which also sought the artifact. The Lion prevented Kallus Typhon of the Death Guard from acquiring the engine for his own twisted ends. And was determined to use it to defeat the Night Lords and their Primarch. Lionel Johnson began to frequently converse with the Tukulka in the aftermath of the battle, confiding with it above all others. And that's from the Angels of Caliban novel, which is the 38th one in the Horus of Heresy series.
Dear gods. There's so many books.
How many are there?
I'm just going to dip my toes into this. Oh, what, the 38? Okay, cool.
I've just gone into Lexicon. As of 2019, there have been 54 Horus Heresy main novels published by Games Workshop. Jeez. Of them, 16 are anthologies of Horus Heresy novellas, short stories, and audio dramas.
So did he win?
Lionel Johnson's got the Tukulka. He's confiding it in it. During the attempts to breach the Ruinstorm and reach Terra, Tukulka demonstrated the limits of its own abilities. It honestly told the Lion that it could not navigate the storm to Terra on its own, frustrating the Lion. At some point towards the end of the Heresy, Tukulka became embedded within the rock.
Just sounds like he's been honest.
Yeah.
He put it in the naughty cupboard.
Yeah. So it's just like, mate, you're asking a lot of me here. I can't do it on my own.
And then,
I've listened to you moan after every battle.
I've listened to you confide with me above all others.
You've taken my wheels off, so I can't leave the room anymore when you try and talk to me about these things. Like, you could, I've just been honest with you. I can't navigate this storm. Right, there you go, under the sink. So that's where you live now, under the sink. Take that, Kukulka.
And it has been written about in the 41st millennium. So much later in the 41st millennium, Cypher revealed that Tukulka was embedded within the rock and that the Dark Angel's dark history of the Fallen could potentially be changed by finding the other two engines and changing history. Which, as we know from many bits of fiction previously written, changing time always goes very, very well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Guaranteed win.
So do we now... take the sword off the Cypher model.
Yes, I think anyone that owns the Cypher model now needs to take the Lion sword off.
Yeah, I'm honest. I actually really liked this book. I think you go into it, it has no disillusions that it's going to be anything other than a Royal Rumble smashdown. And the one thing that I did think, oh, that's a shit. I thought Cypher would appear at some point. Like, I thought Cypher was going to be leading the Risen.
Yeah. And also, at what point did Cypher give Lionel Johnson the Lion Sword?
He was hanging out with the Blood Angels as well.
Was that mentioned?
No, I'm just assuming. He's just there. Right, yeah. Blood Angels. Dante's just got a room and it's got like Cypher, Lionel Johnson, you know, Rogal Dorn, other than one hand, is in there. You know.
Oh dear. Yeah, so it's like, yeah, I think seeing Cypher play a role here would have been cool. He certainly played a role in that bit that I was mentioning. So
yeah,
just to finish off, he also warned that Estellan and Typhus both sought the engines as well. Eventually, all three devices were gathered and a warp rift was summoned over the ruins of Caliban, convinced by Ezekiel to leave history be and trying to prevent nearby fallen forces from accessing the rift first. Azrael destroyed the rift and presumably the three devices. And that is all we know.
There we go. Till now.
And so, fast forward till now, Vashtor and Abaddon have assembled two of these, the Ouroboros and the Plagueheart, and they have assembled it into the Wormwood, which is the planet that was previously Caliban, like a reassembled chaotic demon version of Caliban. And Tukulka, as we've just discussed, is embedded within the rock.
Yeah.
And who has just rocked up into the... He's just...
You just said rocked up.
There we go. That wasn't even intentional.
I know. That's amazing. Well done. I loved it.
And who has just manifested themselves into real space right next to this three-piece puzzle with one of the missing pieces?
It turns out it was a trap after all.
This
thing that we definitely know is going to be a trap because we've said it turns out to be a trap.
I've got a question for you. We definitely knew from Vashtor that there were multiple components spread across the galaxy, which is why the arcs were sent out all over the place. Did they all come together to become part of Wormwood, or did he just need the three? Need the three bits?
Well, so the three bits were the kind of the core bits.
Yeah, they were like the essential bits, weren't they? Without those three bits, it wouldn't work at all. I only know this, Steve, from listening to your podcast.
Yeah, Steve, this is something we have spoken about before, right?
Steve's just pressing those buttons again.
Yeah. same from last week.
Oriac. So the getting the three kind of primary bits, but also assembling the key with as many of the other bits. And it turned out these bits were fragments of Caliban.
Right. Okay.
So obviously Caliban exploded at the culmination of the kind of Luther versus Lionel Johnson clash. And the largest remaining fragment of Caliban is the rock.
I do like that the Wormwood is basically like one of those nailed it videos when people like try and make something that they've seen. It's like, yeah, it's basically Caliban. It's all right. It's close enough, isn't
close
it?
Close enough. Squint, it looks fine.
Yeah. I mean, it is absolute epic trolling on Vashtor's part to make this huge chaosy thing a Dark Angel thing. Like, he is an absolute epic Dark Angels of Chaos troll going on right now, which is impressive.
And that's why they get super angry and therefore overcommit themselves into making a planetfall assault on this.
Which seems a mistake, doesn't it?
There seem to be a lot of things in the 41st millennium where it's like, with all the technology and all the firepower, what are we going to do? We're going to land on the planet and fight, you know.
Yeah,
street to street.
We're gonna fight a demon Primarch.
We're sending the Golden Boys first, and if they get beat up, then we'll bring in someone else. And then it was a bit kind of wasn't very organized, was it?
No, and I think perhaps that's because of the kind of the emotionally charged nature of it all. The Dark Angels kind of saw red and almost descended into some sort of black rage, if you will. Ironic given that the Blood Angels then turn up. So, and in fact, the Blood Angels turning up is a little bit weird because they turn up and I kind of felt like that, like not only to the reader is the reveal of Lionel Johnson being alive and kicking fairly like, it's like, oh, by the way, he's here. But also the reveal to the Dark Angels is a bit weird as well. They're just like, the Blood Angels turn up and the Dark Angels are a bit suspicious, as is their wont. And the Blood Angels are like, oh yeah, by the way, we've got your Primarchs here.
I
think this is a really great awkward phone call. the Dark Angels are literally just like, they've closed comms to Dante and kind of gone, is he joking? Like, is this a really badly timed joke? Like, what's going on? And then they're like, where is he then? And he's like, he's kind of gone already.
Yeah,
I thought it might turn into like a Weekend at Bernie's style situation is what I was hoping for.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it's a little bit awkward, isn't it? It's a little bit awkward.
I just love Dante for having to. It's like, right, I'll make the phone call. Like, no one else wants to do it. I'll do it. Don't worry. But I mean, for when he is, for I know he said Angron can be a bit one-dimensional, but I did love the bit where like a Thunderhawk gunship flies past him and he just like hews it in two. It's like that's. It's like, that's what happens when you fly a Thunderhawk gunship right next to Angron. What did you think was going to happen?
And it's not even a Thunderhawk gunship. It's a Thunderhawk transporter carrying two Bale Predators.
Oh, okay. No, sorry. Yeah. I'm just going to disconnect from the call. I got it wrong. Sorry.
Stop getting Warhammer wrong, Gary.
Stop doing it wrong.
Stop getting Warhammer. Man, but I just like the
that's
idea
what your
of like
want. You should just get rid of me because I get a lot of Warhammer wrong.
But you just think like of all the things, you know, you're fighting on the demon planet, and then you know there's like, you know, multi-ton sized battle tanks raiding from the sky, as well as the wreckage of this, you know, huge logistics transport. You just think, yeah, this is going badly, isn't it?
Yeah. So to catch everyone, let's do a little timeline, because I know we've jumped here and there with everything.
We have.
So we've got Dark Angels know it's a trap. They've interrogated Heretic Astartes from Vashtor's attack on the rock. So they know where they need to go. There's like the Dark Angels librarius do like a little ritual, don't they, to find out what the trap is. And what they find out is like an image of a mirror that's breaking. And it's like, okay, doesn't really, to me, I think you're looking a bit too much into that. But then they follow the signs. Vashtor's made this fake Caliban wormwood, and the Dark Angels decide to, we need to mess this up. We need to destroy it. So they land on the planet. Blood Angels turn up and say, mate, this is a bit weird. We've got your Primarch. He was on board. He's now not. He's probably about somewhere. That's basically what we've got to so far.
Absolutely. And there's an interesting bit, and I think I mentioned it earlier, where you can tell, obviously, you know, that the Primarch returning is such a huge, significant thing for the Imperium. Like deep down, the Blood Angels are obviously like a little bit sad. So,
oh yeah, that's like, that is genuinely a bit like gutting at that bit. That it's like, yeah, out of all, I mean, bit of a harsh move, the Lion appearing on the Blood Angel ship, isn't it? Just go for an Ultramarine ship. They've got their Primarch back. Like, hey, guess who's not getting a Primarch? I'm gonna come see you. Like, you get to transport me there. Who also, I could just walk through this weird forest thing. So I don't actually need you to do this.
Any bitterness Dante felt at making this announcement, he kept to himself. For it was not the fault of the Dark Angels that Sanguinius would never return to his sons as the Lion now did. All the Blood Angels' gene sire would ever be to his sons was an echo of nobility and madness in their veins. That's cool.
Daddy issues.
So that's where we're at. The Dark Angels make planetfall and are fighting their way through the planet. I mean, knocking out all these kind of the key assets on the planet somehow. And Azrael is leading the charge. And they come across the sort of a Khorne summoning circle. Angron is then summoned. And effectively, Angron then just goes, does Angron things. And kind of Azrael's put on the back foot somewhat. The fight goes back and forth. But then Dante arrives. The Blood Angels all arrive on planet. And again, the Imperial forces kind of get the initiative back. And then Angron and Dante are having a kind of a duel. And Dante is effectively at the end of this duel, kind of like cast asunder. And is in that kind of like injured, you know, awaiting the fatality of Angron. And just before like the killing blow strikes, like this is amazing moment. And do you know what, as like a fan of 40K for, you know, goodness knows how many years, reading this genuinely kind of some of the bits in, like from this moment on,
it
some
is
of the bits
bit,
of the book,
yeah,
like really gave me a bit goosebumps, like amazing. Yeah. It's such a defining moment in this game's narrative, like the return of a Primarch. And yeah, it's amazing.
You actually feel like once they get stuck in that, you kind of feel like, yeah, I think the Lion's got this. I think it's such a cool moment. I think it really feels like a realistic fight when you've got these two massive characters smashing it out.
I do like as well that it's kind of, the way it's described is that how sickened Lionel Johnson is at what his brother's become. And Angon's just kind of like, I'm going to beat the man up with a shield. He's like, he knows, he kind of knows it's his brother, but it's like, because the butcher's nails are so synced in, he's just going, he looks like the hardest one to beat up. I'm going to try and beat him up. But considering, like, I think these kind of fights can be like super one dimensional, but I think this fight is actually super cool. Like, I really like how the lion is basically just annoying Angron by being super defensive in his fight style. And he's just basically letting the Emperor's shield, whenever Angron just hits the shield, it just sends him flying. And Angron tries this tactic at least like 5 or 6 times.
Yeah, because the lion's drawing Angron away from Dante, isn't he?
Yeah.
Dante's body, where he's not dead, but he's down. And but I quite liked the little insight to Angron that Angron started getting frustrated. It's just like, I'm not supposed to be fighting this one dude all this time. I should be into regiments by now, not just one.
It said, like, it felt like he's not spilt blood in a decade. And it's like, it's because he's been fighting the line for like 6 minutes, which shouldn't happen. Yeah, that bit is really great.
So this is the scene, which is really cool. So it's Dante. This is set in the context of Dante having been smashed down onto the floor, and he lay still and did not rise. Azrael cried out in dismay as Angron threw back his head and roared his triumph. The Blood Angel's chapter master lay defenseless before him, open to the killing blow. Yet, as Azrael watched powerless, shadows suddenly coiled about the Red Angel and his victim. Tendrils of mist obscured the figures, and from amidst the vapors spread incongruous green shoots of what looked to Azrael like plant life. Shifting shapes unfurled, resembling nothing so much as a sketch of a dream of half-remembered trees, their dense boughs more shadow than substance. In the next instant, Azrael's bewilderment gave way to awe. A tall figure in a flowing cloak stepped from the mists to place himself between Angron and Dante. Space marines in black armor manifested around him and spread out down the steps, but Azrael barely noticed them. He could only stare at the warrior with the glowing blade and glinting shield. It did not matter that Azrael had only seen him before in tapestries, frescoes, and stained glass. His very blood knew this warrior's identity. His gene seed sang with the truth. Teetering as close to being overwhelmed as it was possible for a space marine to come, Azrael went to one knee. He was looking at the lion, returned to his gene sons at the hour of their greatest need. Hell yes. That, like...
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yes! Yeah. Yes! So cool. So cool.
Yeah.
Oh, because we've heard that phrase, like, the lion will return to his sons at the hour of their greatest... We've heard that so much, and this is it. And honestly, it's just got me so pumped. I'm like, I am now going to build an Dark Angels army.
To how quickly did you think about changing your? I assume the Craftworld Combat Patrol has already gone in a cupboard.
No, that's a side project. You know, I think replacing Craftworld Space Marines, like, but my Space Marine,
Dad, don't try and convince us that you are capable of a main project and a side project.
Everything's side
project. If you mean side project as in goes in the side cupboard, I believe side project now.
Well. But yeah, I think my Astartes project currently is looking at, like, it's going to be Blood Angels. But reading this, I'm just like, oh my God, it's so cool. But really interestingly, what we've seen from 10th edition, the previews so far, it doesn't look like there's going to be sub-faction specific rules. So just kind of briefly segueing outside of Arx Fomen, the rules suggest that the detachment you build sort of give you the sub-faction rules, or almost like the sub-faction rules. So you don't pick Ultramarines and get a load of Ultramarines rules. You don't pick Blood Angels and get Blood Angels rules. You pick, like, the super bike-focused army. And you're like, okay, cool, well, I can use that for Ravenwing. I can use that for White Scars. I can use that for the, I don't know, like, the Salamanders Bike Company or whatever. Like, just because Salamanders are famous for their flamers and White Scars are famous for their bikes, doesn't mean the White Scars don't have, like, whole spearheads of Land Raiders to do kind of armored assault and can't do, like, siege warfare. Like, the Imperial Fists don't have, like, the kind of monopoly on that.
Yeah, it's sounding very interesting, isn't it? Like, it definitely gets around the whole that chapter's way better than this chapter thing.
Exactly.
Like, I don't believe that's how it will stay. Like, I believe chapter tactics will be back in some way, but it would be bloody impressive if they don't. if they just go, no, it's just they have the oath of the moment. That's it. That's what Space Marines do.
And there'll be different versions of that for the different flavors of Space Marines. But yeah. For me, what's exciting is that I can build an Angels of Death army. I can build a bunch of Space Marines. I can paint some of them red. I can paint some of them green. And then I can just use them all in a Oath of the Moment attachment or whatever the next one's going to be. Yeah. And it means that it doesn't matter that they're different colors. And I can just, for me, that's really exciting from a like narrative player's perspective, because it means you can recreate cool moments like you read about in books like this, in the Arcs of Omen, where you do have, say, Space Marines from different chapters fighting side by side. And it doesn't matter that they're different colors, and they don't need to like neatly fit into specific detachments. Like, this is my Ultra Marines attachment. This is my White Scars attachment. You can just say, hey, do you know what? I've got a Space Marines army. Yeah. Some of the red, some of the green. They're all working hand in hand because this is to represent the Angels of Death on Wormwood.
Yeah, it's super cool. What that kind of style, Rich, as I do on every time I record with you gents, I have to bring it back to the original Vigilus book. Like, that you got like some super cool detachments in that were just like, here's the Orcs big stompy dread detachment, and it's like, that's super cool. Like, there's nothing else really about it. It's just like, you got this relic and this little rule, and that was the rule, and it was like, that's really sweet. And that's kind of what it's sounding like, which would be amazing if that's just the way 40k is done now.
Yeah, really looking forward to that. But yeah, we're not going to talk about 10th too much because we need to get on with the rest of this book. So the lion turns up, and then the rest of it really is Lionel Johnson and Angron having their kind of one-on-one duel.
Their brother Tiff.
Absolutely. A bit of sibling rivalry.
Yeah.
In angry sibling rivalry. Meanwhile, Azrael then kind of goes up to do like the medevac of Dante, and they start kind of working out what, you know, they start extracting, conducting a withdrawal. Meanwhile, we then cut to Vashtor, who...
Sneaky bugger that he is.
Sneaky little so-and-so, who effectively just does this, like, kamikaze suicide run at the rock, doesn't he?
Well, what I think got missed out is where he found, like, a janitor's costume to put on and, like, a fake moustache and just walked through the rock to get the engine. As he's just super sneaky and gets through and is just like, here we go, this is what I wanted, see you later.
Yeah, which is weird because, like... What did he need when he was last literally on the rock? What didn't he have? Did he not have one of the other two?
I'm not sure that's made clear.
Vashtor was the last book before this one, wasn't it?
Well, no, there's Farsight.
No, was it Farsight? Yeah. No, but I mean like actual book.
Yeah, the actual book that was relevant to the story, that was connected to the story in any meaningful way.
It could just be that, it's not as thought out as it could be. Or I do like the fact that it could just be like, no matter what happens, he is still a demon of chaos. So he does do stuff a bit messed up, where it's like, I could just take the engine now, or I could do like the chaosy villainy thing, leave it here, get the Dark Angels to come to us, and also slaughter nearly every Dark Angel along the way. Because he does like the whole evil villain thing of like, these guys don't know that I've made a fake Caliban. It won't be as funny if I just take this now. So I'll leave it here. Then they can come see the fake Caliban I made. So my gut feeling is actually it's just chaos being chaos.
Chaos gonna chaos, right?
Yeah, exactly. But he opens the sink cupboard.
He does. There and he finds the Chocolca engine. He kind of
next to the toasty machine.
Yeah, that's probably Chocolca needs engine. A bit of another clean.
Yeah.
Since it's last been used. So he does this kind of charge with his the Auric Myriad, which is his AI turned Arc of Omen. And he kind of charges it at full blast in sort of towards the rock. And just kind of when he's within range, sufficient range, he kind of projects himself in a way that only a demon, a kind of Dark Mechanicum demon can, and burrows his essence into the surface of the rock and goes deep and deep and deep into the cells and comes across the cell in which the Chocolca engine is kept prisoner. And effectively, they have this kind of devil's bargain where... He's like, cool, do you want to like live up to your destiny and be united with the other two of the little trio? And the Chocolca engine's like, hell's yes, I'm down. And they then just kind of like warp magic themselves away, don't they?
Yeah, there's no real way the Dark Angels could have stopped that, is there?
No, I mean, the only way they could have stopped that, Gary, is perhaps by not turning up at the trap location.
No, Dan, always the best way to destroy a trap is to turn up and activate the trap. We know that.
We know that now.
It's the only way to be sure that the trap isn't going to work.
And so then that's pretty much the evil cunning plan's complete. And the Auric Myriad and like everyone on board that Space Hulk is like, what? And they're obviously in range of this, the rock and all its defense batteries. So it just gets blasted in smithereens. Meanwhile, Vashtor and the Tukulka engine is back on the planet. And he kind of plugs the third one in, presses the big red button, and the whole planet goes topsy-turvy and starts to kind of activate. And you've kind of got this, like, the temple is falling down around us after we've taken the relic off the plinth kind of moment. All the space marines are kind of, I suppose, like tactically withdrawing or running away. And the fight between the Lion and Angron is coming to an end. There's this like classic, really classic kind of enemy jumps at you and you don't move, but lift your sword up and impale the enemy on your sword.
If it works, yeah.
What I really liked about it is it just made me feel like the Lion had never used his sword in the fight up to this point.
Yeah. he just keeps booping him on the snoot with a shield.
Yeah, he never really mentions that he uses fealty, but he uses the shield about 6 times. Then I think Aragorn just goes, oh, crap, I forgot about that. I forgot he also has a sword. But yeah, he gets banished, doesn't he?
He gets a sword through the face.
Yeah.
He gets a sword through the neck and then a shield through the face. He gets kind of like a coup de grace delivered by the shield, which is pretty badass.
Yeah.
It's awesome. And then it's like, oh, well, I'm pretty sure I'm going to see him again.
And then the kind of that's really the sort of the book starting to wrap up in terms of narrative. And you then see this the Blood Angels and Dark Angels start to exfiltrate towards the kind of the only safe areas of the planet that's effectively imploding. And Azrael and Dante are extracting. And just as they're kind of like really super close to the extraction site, when a whole bunch of new demons reappear, including a great unclean one. And then what happens then, Gary?
So then we have the awesome Risen make a reappearance to hold off the Nurgle demons for the others to make their escape. And there's a little moment where Azrael's like, oh, I'm a bit sickened by this. And then, what was it? Was it Borz? Was that it? Borz? B-O-R-Z?
Who we're introduced right at the start.
The eye patch and the power fist.
Yeah, absolutely. He's the chap that's kind of sparring with his Primarch at the start. Yeah.
And there's the epic line, Dan.
Love it.
Hold on. I've closed it, Dan. Have you got it?
I've got it. So, Azrael's like kind of roiling with this kind of weird, you know, he spent centuries, millennia hunting down the fallen only for them to arrive and be his savior in, you know, he's about to get kind of killed, isn't he? And then this like black power fist just like smashes through this demon. And he says to
Urkablax is the demon.
Urkablax. Yeah. Duty is its own reward, Supreme Grandmaster. He reminded us. He expects no less of you. Yeah. Again, I'm like, that's more Dark Angels into my basket.
But it's just super cool. I wasn't like expecting the Fallen to be anything in this. And then when we've got the Risen, it's like, and it's just the fact that at the very beginning, Borz is kind of like, well, I know you believe us, Johnson, but they won't. And he's just like, look, if I tell them, they'll do it, all right? Daddy's got the final say.
But yeah, no, they proved themselves, didn't they? They proved it, and I think actually kind of modelling a Risen, because they're still going to look like the Fallen. So combining those together into an army would be super cool.
Definitely. I think you could easily do a Risen force that would look great. Or like Dan said, even with the new detachments of what it sounded like, you could just have a unit of Risen in your army.
Yeah. That works.
You know,
I think what would look really cool.
It's just a unit like any of the others, same rules, but it's just a really cool looking unit.
Yeah.
What I think would look really cool would be using the Dark Angels Mark VI Heresy heads or the old Mark III ones, because that's very characteristically kind of Dark Angel. But on Primaris, so you know, what are the Risen going to look like when they get kind of incorporated into the Dark Angels properly?
Mm.
You know, we've seen from Azrael that you can use different marks of armor helmet on the Mark 10 power armor that the Primaris wear. So maybe using like Dark Angels Heresy heads on Primaris and then painting them black, you could have like a Risen squad.
It would be super cool. Like, that sounds great. And it's that whole, like, for me, it's kind of that kill team itch scratch.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I don't need to do a full army of these, but here's a really cool unit that looks really distinct on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Like, that's cool. It's like, seeing these kind of rules is what makes me want to do, like, add a Death Watch unit to my Imperial Fists, but it's just an Imperial Fist unit, but done up as Death Watch.
Yeah.
Like, that'd be real. I think you could easily do that for the Risen and it would look great.
Definitely. I think the Risen wouldn't necessarily join them and go, right, let's go to the quartermaster and get some shiny new armor. They would kind of carry it as a badge of honor. I think in some ways the rest of the angels would want to see them as who they were and accept them as who they were and have them stay the same. I don't think it would be something they would ever change.
And I think that's the beauty of the Warhammer hobby, is you can kind of do what you want, really.
Yeah. 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 So whether you're reenacting that moment on Wormwood or whether you're 100 years into the future, you decide. You make the models yourself.
You could literally just use the Heresy kits, straight up and say, whatever. And they're fairly well-sized next to the Primaris models now, aren't they?
Yes, the better.
So, and then in the kind of the final two stages of this book. So first of all, that whole kind of narrative arc finishes and the Imperial forces withdraw and Abaddon is sat there kind of ruminating on the fact that this has gone quite well and the demon hasn't betrayed him, and which I think is a surprise to us all.
Abaddon. Like Vashtal's on the level.
And there's a good few paragraphs here, which is Abaddon felt a mixture of triumph and bitterness as he watched them go. On the one hand, his moment of victory had arrived. The loyalists were fleeing and he had exacted a colossal butcher's bill upon them. Scores of broken wrecks tumbled through the void or had been reduced to slowly expanding debris clouds. Between the void battle and the surface war, shocking numbers of loyalist space marines had been slain. The unforgiven chapters might never regain the strength that they had possessed before this day. On the other hand, Abaddon still felt victory was incomplete, especially in the light of the news that Lionel Johnson had stepped from ancient history to rejoin the Long War. The Despoiler could not help but wonder, in the light of Gulliman's Indomitus Crusade, what impact a second Loyalist Primarch would have upon the wider strategic picture. Yet for all of that, victory was indisputably his. And Vashtal's, he conceded to himself, as the Archophane's voice crackled from vox emitters throughout the vengeful spirit. Sounding uncharacteristically gleeful, the demon recommended Abaddon withdraw his fleet to a safe distance. The key had awoken. The dissonance engine was ready. Wormwood lived, and the realm of real space would never be the same again. Now, the hunt for the lock could begin in earnest, and then the weapon. And that's kind of... like, cut to black, end of film, credits roll, but knowing that we have an upcoming sequel, i.e.
Yeah, yeah, we've already seen the trailer for the sequel.
Yeah. I have to say, it's kind of, it wasn't quite the ending I was hoping for. It was kind of just the beginning of the next bit, if that makes sense. It ends
like any good, series, it's built, it ends on a cliffhanger. And sets it well up for a sequel, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Season two.
I really hope they pick it up. That's the thing.
Yeah, because like, you were saying really earlier, like 10th is all about like the western edge of the galaxy and all about the Tyranids.
Yeah, and it's there's a tendency for these huge narrative changing moments to kind of be left for the next thing to be picked up. Because this is cool, like we were discussing, Chaos 1.
Yeah.
Like, that's cool. Like, I genuinely was proper surprised because I was expecting them to get there, blah, blah, blah. Vashtal doesn't get, shakes his fist next time gadget. And then, but no, he gets it. The plan went exactly how Vashtor wanted it to, and they created the Wormwood, and it's activated, and it's onwards to do what it's meant to do. And I was like, that's amazing. That's really cool that they've decided to go, no, Chaos got it right this time. They won.
Mad suggestion. The lock could always be on the western side.
Yeah. And what better way to get to the western side than burrowing through unreality?
Yeah. So maybe that's not a moon could turn up at any moment and spill out in search. That would be a messy fight, wouldn't it?
Yeah. As I said to you guys as well, when you had like the double page spread of the galaxy and how that faction is affecting something in a codex, I just really hope you see the Wormwood just chomping its way through the map onto the next bit. And like, you just suddenly like, there were planets in the last codex hit. And it's just I just want to see the adventures of the Wormwood.
Of the dissonance engine. The little dissonance engine that could.
Yeah, exactly. And the Eldar going, what the hell is that?
Yes.
which nicely segues onto the final bit. You know, we've had the credits roll, and then we have this kind of like Marvel-esque scene
I'd actually walked out of the cinema at this point.
You had, didn't you?
Oh no, there's another bit at the end. I was like, oh, I'd actually walked out of the cinema. So Dan, I look forward to this bit. You go for it.
Gary was like, yeah, I finished it. I got up to this bit. I was like, dude, turn the page. There's another bit.
because I saw the double page spread of Angron and
because there's a bit of art right immediately afterwards, which...
yeah, and the lion. I was like, oh, it's going to be on to just like armies of photos of armies now, and it's like, no, Dan said there's actually a little cutscene that I completely missed.
So this final cutscene, it is an exchange between the one and only Inquisitor Kotiaz, who we spoke about on a very recent episode, and we said how cool that model still was, and one of his interrogators. And his interrogator effectively delivers him a message. And the message is from one of their agents, who is a Mordian officer aboard one of the ships within the Blood Angels fleet. And it's kind of recorded on his like GoPro camera thing. And it kind of shows the carnage on the ship and the madness that's happening outside. And effectively, they then watch the dissonance engine activate, go all the way up to 11 and burrow into unreality. And one of the sort of crew members, one of the kind of tech priests, says, detecting correlating choristic data points to xenoform subrealm gateway activation, but on a macrocosmic scale beyond cogitational capacity. This is an impossibility. This is an affront to the Omnisci. So Kotiaz kind of picks up on this and is like, xenoform subrealm gateway activation? If that's so, where are the Eldarianists? And the interrogator then have a little conversation. And Kotiaz points out that some of the like Eldar Farseers came to him as allies and tried to kind of like talk about this. And he was like, nah, Xenos scum, you're lying. You duplicitous so-and-sos. So he kind of, he points out that they've tried to speak to him about it before. And but he kind of wants to know what's going on. And then the interrogator says, oh, and the Bale fleet's lord, many are still at large. Have they served their purpose, or do they still follow some wider pattern we cannot see? And he basically, kind of the final paragraph is, activate every asset we have, he commanded. Make contact with the Grey Conclave and our agents within Fleet Septimus. Make no mistake, interrogator, our enemies have won a great and terrible victory here. One that we, in our ignorance, cannot yet fully comprehend. We must understand what it is the heretics have created and what they seek to do with it, and we must learn how to counteract it. If we fail, then I fear they will board upon their triumph to the ruin of all the God Emperor's realm. And that is the end of the Arcs of Omen.
Yeah, that's it. That's the series done, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a cool like end, I think. For me, this was my favourite of the books.
Yes, I agree. It was the wrap up we needed, and I think we've actually had some quite serious impacts on chapters and models and things that we play. So I think that's always exciting to see, rather than it just kind of having to step around that. So crack in more, please.
And interestingly, Kotiaz talks about the Grey Conclave. Now, do we think he's referring to the Grey Knights?
I think that's what you would assume, wouldn't you? Whether that is or not, that's after seeing that, that's what I assumed it was.
Yeah.
But doesn't mean it is.
Yeah, which begs the question, what do updated Grey Knights, what do Grey Knights in Mark 10 look like? Primaris Grey Knights.
They look like Dan's next project.
No. Do you know what? Grey Knights are one of the things I have been... I'm not too fussed about. I don't. Grey Knights aren't my thing.
There we go. Steve, remember that?
Yeah. We will etch that on the Ashes of the Imperium whiteboard.
Yeah.
And then we shall see.
Grey Knights are not my thing. There we go.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Inquisition forces, though, led by a new Kotiaz model.
Yeah.
And we've seen that, in the back of the book, you've obviously got all your usual sketch of the boarding actions rules. And there is a faction called Agents of the Imperium.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is great to see all these rules for all these models. Obviously, this is going to be a bit fleeting, but knowing that we're going to get...
fleeting, if you will.
Oh, that's a bit of a burn. But it's good to know that we should be seeing indexes for them when 10s drop. So yeah, it's great to play them.
And you've got the Voidsman at arms and the Arbites, haven't you? So, you know, there's definitely an army there.
And I think isn't there going to be a box set, boarding party box set?
Yes. So that's like an ultimate kill team box.
It is.
You get two boxes of the navy breaches and one set of the rogue trader agents with like the, you know, with the rogue trader and the voidsman and stuff like that. So it's one hell of a boarding actions box.
Yeah. That's good. That's a good box set.
Mm. Oh, and an assassin, don't you? You get an Evisor assassin.
Yeah, you do get an Evisor assassin as well. Yeah. It's super sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. 20 navy breaches, 10 Elucidan Starstriders, which was the sort of individual kill team that came out in the
Rogue Trader box.
That's right. With the Gellipox infected.
Yeah.
And an Evisor assassin. I would have liked to have seen 10 Navy Breachers, 10 Arbites, and then the Elucidan Starstriders.
I mean, that would literally be the ultimate kill team box. That's the issue.
Yeah.
Or actually, do you know what I would have liked to have seen is 20 Breachers and, instead of the Star Striders, just taking the Arbites.
Yeah, fair.
That would have been at least easier to buy into an army, because you're not running two units of Star Striders, are you? You know, if you're looking at these boarding patrols of, like, because some of the boarding patrols are amazing. Like, look at the even just the Votann one. You've got 5 Berserks, 5 Hearthguard, and 10 Warriors led by Champion. You could buy a couple of those boxes, or you could buy like a couple of boarding patrols and one combat patrol, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't necessarily see you buying two boxes of boarding patrol for the Imperial Agents.
No.
But anyway. So that concludes our Arcs of Omen coverage with that final book. And we hope you've enjoyed our kind of narrative overviews of this narrative series. And you can join us for our next episode, where we'll be covering some of the Warhammer community reveals about 10th edition. We'll be talking about some of the rules that have been previewed, some of the lore changes. We'll be discussing that amazing trailer as well in detail. And we'll be talking about some of our hopes and fears for the next edition, which is going to be released in a few months' time.
Can't wait.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
And if you want to get a hold of us, we are at AOTI on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We've also launched our YouTube channel. So all of our podcasts, the audio of our podcast is going onto the YouTube channel, just as a kind of like, there's no actual video content on there for now, but watch this space and there might be in the future. So until next time, keep calm and crusade on.
Cheers, guys.
Bye.